Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs here at Princeton University. And this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of molecular biology and neuroscience and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
Sam, one of the themes that we keep coming back to in all of our conversations, I think, has been the structure of politics is often as important as the game-changing moments that people focus on. The institutions, the processes, the way that the democracy works is something we don't always pay attention to. We had several guests in the fall who spoke to us about some of the voting restriction laws and the potential impact they might have, but often these are not the themes that receive a lot of attention. And there's a number of issues that I think loom large right now: gerrymandering, voting laws, federalism, that really are front and center in what's happening and what's going to happen, even if it's not what's covered in a lot of the newspapers or television stations. And there are some deep-rooted challenges that we face as a nation that we need to discuss more. So we are fortunate today to have Heather Gerken, who is the Skelly Wright Professor of Law at the Yale Law School, and will be the Dean of the Yale Law School starting in July. She was recently elected to that position. She's one of the country's leading experts on constitutional law and election law. She's a founder of the Nationalist School of Federalism. Her work focuses on federalism, diversity, and dissent. She's been called an intellectual guru in the New York Times, and her work and her scholarship's been featured all over the Atlantic, Boston Globe, the New York Times, and NPR, and much more. Her work on election reform has had an impact on public policy, and she has been running one of the most innovative clinics in local government law, the San Francisco Affirmative Litigation Project. She's also a terrific teacher. She clerked for Judge Stephen Reinhardt and Justice David Souter. And she has just become a really exciting voice in the legal world. She also served as a senior advisor in the Obama campaign in 2008 and 2012. She proposed the Democracy Index, which is a system for ranking election systems that the Pew Charitable Trust adopted. And so she's also on the Board of Trustees of Princeton University. So it's really wonderful to have you here. Thanks for joining our show.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe we can start with your work on federalism, which I found interesting since I first encountered it. I remember years ago in the 90s, I was a research fellow at Brookings, and someone gave a paper about federalism, and it was primarily about the ways federalism inhibited robust progressive policies. And I remember asking a question at the time, couldn't federalism ever be something that had progressive purposes? And people laughed just about in the room. But the conversation seems to have shifted, and your work has been really central. Could you talk a bit about what you've been saying about federalism and how you conceive it?
Sure. My view is federalism is for everyone. It doesn't have a political valence. And so the way to think about federalism is not as something associated with one side or another, but simply as a tool for bringing about change and as a tool for embedding stability. And it can do both of those things at the same time. In thinking about it, I'll just say it's useful for progressives, because if you're a progressive, you often worry about federalism because of the legacy of the Civil Rights era and the New Deal. But I'll just say this is not your father's federalism, and it's not your grandfather's federalism. So the biggest worry, I think, that looms for progressives is the fear that if you have power in the states and localities, that they'll be shielded from national norms. And that was the old federalism. That's your father's federalism. But in today's federalism, if the national government wants to enforce a national norm, it can. If it wants to enforce a robust equality norm, it can. Despite all the efforts of the Supreme Court to protect state power, they have failed. So that means that the states are part of a vibrant system where fights about national norms and equality are taking place at the state and local level. So that's the way to think about it, not as these entities that are shielded from national norms, but as the entities that generate national norms. If you start thinking about it that way, then you start to realize actually that both sides can and in fact do use it to put forward their causes, to build movements, to effect change. The most spectacular example is the same-sex marriage movement. And when I began writing in 2004, that was just beginning. But over the last number of years, I think it's been clearly shown that states and localities and state and local power really matter when you're thinking about politics and changing people's minds and putting forth an equality project.
And so the argument, it was always connected to the civil rights, the kind of states' rights arguments of the time, and the other fear. You're arguing you can have the national norms and the federalism project in some ways, because the counter argument was always, you know, if you put your energy on this, healthcare in a state or in an even smaller locality, ultimately you give up the project of trying to ensure that everyone would have this, because ultimately some states, like Mississippi, simply wouldn't play ball. But that's not the case, you're saying.
No, I mean, so if you're a nationalist like I am, and I should just note that by nationalist, I don't quite mean the way that the phrase has been bandied about in the last 6 months. I mean a nationalist in the sense of a New Deal nationalist, someone who believes that it's perfectly acceptable for the national government to play the supremacy card Trump whenever it feels the need to do so, and that states are not special and shouldn't be shielded in any way from national norms and national law. So that, just to be clear about what I mean about being a nationalist. But it's foolish to think that if you pursue things at the state and local level, that you are undermining your ability to pursue them at the national level. In fact, if you pursue things at the state and local level, you're far more likely to get them at the national level. There are all kinds of useful reasons to do it. One is just the old-fashioned laboratories of democracy idea. So where did our national healthcare system start? Where did Obamacare begin? It began in San Francisco and Massachusetts. If you think about just about any national program, it often began at the state and local level and built out. Think about the gay rights movement. Same-sex marriage was not going to happen at the national level at the time that it began lurking at the state and local level, but there were concentrations of power in cities and some states where people could get their agenda across. And once you start getting your agenda across in some places, you can build out. You can use it as a rallying cry. You can use it as an example. There's all kinds of power associated with it. I mean, just think about one good example. People in the same-sex marriage movement had been arguing for a long time in favor of same-sex marriage. They'd been invoking all of their powers under the First Amendment, right? They've been speeches and rallies and editorials. So what is it that changed the game? What changed the game was the fact that Massachusetts and San Francisco started issuing licenses to same-sex couples. So suddenly you had a real-life instantiation of the idea. Suddenly Americans across the country were having beamed into their television sets pictures of really happy weddings, except there were two brides or two grooms. And suddenly everyone actually had to make a decision about what they thought about it. So politicians had wanted to kind of stay out of the game because it was too dangerous, but they had to make a decision. The Obama administration had to make a decision. Was it going to recognize these marriages? States all across the country had to decide, would they recognize these marriages? So it changed the discussion in a way that mattered enormously in a very short amount of time. And that was precisely because they engage in what I call dissenting by deciding, right? They put a dissenting outlier position into policy. And as a result, they had a lot more power than the usual dissenter does.
But if I think about, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. So sometimes states and cities are agents of change, and sometimes they're the agents of stasis. So if I think about what in my lifetime federalism has been, it's been things like resisting the consequences of the civil rights movement, right? Like that's been a major touchstone for a lot of people who use the word federalism over the last, say, I don't know, four decades or so. What did federalism mean before the civil rights era? You mentioned Franklin Roosevelt. 40 to 80 years ago, what did people want who wanted federalism?
Yeah, so two great debates have shaped our understanding of federalism. So the first was around the New Deal. And that was a question about national power versus state power. The question was, would we allow the national government to regulate in areas that states had traditionally regulated? It was fought over something called the Commerce Clause, which is, I know, a little bit of a deep dive for non-law people. But in essence, could Congress use its power under the Commerce Clause to regulate things that had traditionally belonged to the states? Without it, the national government would have been paralyzed, unable to address the questions that it had to address. And so the New Deal in the wake of the New Deal was to allow the federal government to jointly regulate with the states in areas of traditional state concern. So that's what it meant 80 years ago. After the Civil Rights Movement, federalism meant states' rights, which was an idea which lawyers would call sovereignty. It was the idea that states could invoke states' rights to shield themselves from national norms. That, too, is gone. States have been sheared of sovereignty. Every time the Rehnquist and Roberts Court has tried to put up some barrier to national regulation, there's always been a workaround. So what I would say, and I actually find people, this resonates much more than it used to, I think there was a way in which progressives used to think, oh, well, the national government has more powerful equality norms than states and localities. Now I think what people realize is actually those norms aren't nearly as robust as we thought they were. And if you want to make them more robust, the way to do it is to build up political support in the states and localities. So I'm with you. So when I began, I said it's a source of change and stasis. One of the reasons why we ended up letting states and localities get away with resistance is because we didn't have a robust enough norm in the first place. And I'll just contrast that, for example, with the same-sex marriage movement, where interestingly, you know, the day that the same-sex marriage movement came down, only one clerk in one small town resisted federal law. That's a kind of extraordinary moment, right? There's still other forms of resistance right now taking place on the religious dimensions, but when you have a robust national norm, it's much easier to police the outliers. When the national norm isn't robust enough, we tend to decentralize, right? Decentralization, it's not the cause of stasis. It's the tool by which we let things go when we don't really have a strong enough norm in the first place.
Well, to get away from the logic and the reasoning, and I'm sorry to do this since I like logic and reasoning, how much of this is driven by where the votes are? So currently, people who would like progressive policies are not in control of either chamber of Congress, nor are they in control of the White House. Some would argue that nobody's in control of the White House. But anyway, but the point is certainly Democrats are not in control of the White House right now. So how much of this is just going where, you know, it's like robbing banks, where the money is, where the policy changes could happen are at the local level. Therefore, what people should do who want certain kinds of changes should do is work at the local level. Is it, you see what I'm saying? Just an exercise of pushing on the levers where they are.
It's partially that. So it's often true that, right, the states and localities are where you go when you're out of power in Washington. But I'll just say, everything that I've been describing to you happened during the Obama period, right? So even though Obama was in control of the presidency, there all the work on environmental issues, the work on healthcare, all of these things began at the state and local level and built out. It's hard. You can't just add water and have a national movement or a national consensus, right? You have to build it out. And a really powerful tool for building things out is to instantiate it at the state and local level where you have power. And you have to know the other side is doing exactly the same thing.
Right.
So we could have this conversation about gun control and abortion regulations. That's also happening where there are concentrations of power that are different from the median.
Can we have this conversation about climate change now that the United States has apparently started to pull the levers to move out of the Paris Accord? And surveys indicate that something like 70% of Americans have an opinion in favor of the Paris Accord. And so cities and states have started to come out of the woodwork saying, well, we like the Paris Accord, and so we'll stick with it. Does that fit with federalism, or does it go against the executive branch's ability to make foreign policy?
Well, this is a different piece of my portfolio, but I'll just say that one of the things that you learn about the national government is that it's actually not nearly as big as we think it is. So one of the really interesting sources of state power, which is not at all how lawyers think about it or most people think about it, is the simple fact that the national government depends heavily on states and localities to carry out a lot of its policy. For example, states do a lot of the regulating in the environmental arena. And California has for a long time, by virtue of the fact that it's a super state, it's enormous. Right? California has actually been setting national policy on emissions. Why has it done so? Because it says if you want to go into the California market, you have to meet emissions. As a result, we all drive cars that are better and environmentally. There are limits to it, right? So when I began, I noted if you don't win the national level at some point, the national government will have tools in response. So I don't want to say it's
like
be all
Texas
end all.
Textbooks, school books.
I mean, I will just say, sometimes progressive, when I go and make this pitch, there's sometimes an impulse to say, well, will it always work for us? And it's like, well, no, you still need to win national elections
and
local
elections.
So the
idea is that it's a second level conversation. There's a national level of policymaking, whether it be in courts or in Congress, and there's a second level of conversation happening all around the nation. And so is the idea of federalism just that's a two-way conversation that is always with us? Is that the general idea?
It's, I would say, I call it the discursive benefits of structure, which is kind of a fancy pants means for saying that if you think you want change, don't only look to the First Amendment, look to federalism. That's actually not what most people do, but if you want to affect, I mean, this is actually, I'll say, this is something that lawyers, law professors, academics don't generally think, but virtually anyone who's involved in a social movement knows this and has been doing it for generations. So I don't want to suggest it's new, but the answer is federalism is actually a tool for affecting change. And if you give it up, or if you neglect it, or if you don't run people in state and local offices, over time you're going to find that you're slipping in the national conversation as well, because you're not using all the tools that are available to you.
There's probably an element too with more of the media being national, meaning more people getting their news, although it's partisan, but they're getting it from national sources as opposed to local newspapers. That part of the dynamic is that when things happen in one state, it is easier to generate attention to a policy change.
Exactly.
Or a movement like you were saying with same-sex marriage, for example.
Yeah, so back to your father's federalism, the old picture of federalism was the idea that there'd be these distinct cultural entities called states and every one of them would be different. I don't think that exists anymore, right? It's a national politics. There are different sites for fighting it out. And because those sites are configured differently politically, with some with large red margins and some with large blue margins, you're having the national conversation, but it's really a national conversation. That is, those fights aren't just about what we want to do in one state or another. Those are national organizations using sites of power to further their national ends. So it's just a mistake to imagine these things as separate these days.
Okay, let's turn to voting, another area. You have so many areas of expertise that I don't think we can get through all of them. But this is vital. So we had
the constitutional law pentathlon.
We had a bunch of guests in the fall, like I said, Ari Berman of The Nation, a few others who spoke about voting restriction laws and the impact that they were having. Maybe you can update us a little bit on where things are with any of the significant court cases that are going on.
Yeah, I would say that the Supreme Court left standing a decision that was pretty good in North Carolina. I would say that was not a long-term victory, but a short-term victory in a very long war. So that is the cheery version.
This is the voting rights.
In voting rights
for early voting. I think it was the law was shortening the period for early voting, and
it did a bunch of things. I mean, there's a set of tools in the toolbox, and it took advantage of just about everyone. So that's the, if you worry about restrictions on the ballot that are unnecessary, that's the cheery part of it. I'll just tell you. Because the Supreme Court, this is the difference between people, lawyers and everyone else. The Supreme Court didn't make a decision. It just left the decision standing. And so people often infer from the Supreme Court's failure to act that that's something bigger than it is. So I don't think the fight is over at the Supreme Court level. On the downside is the states have figured this out. And anywhere there is a group that is going to benefit from it politically, they're going to enact these regulations. And so it's the election administration, since Bush v. Gore in particular, but since the voter ID debate is really gone, is election administration has become completely politicized. And as a result, people are imagining it like gerrymandering as a tool for furthering their political ends. And they've gotten actually to be quite blatant about it. And that's really unfortunate if you care about election administration, because that's really a technocratic question, not a political question. And yet it's become completely politicized.
But this depends a little bit on why the Supreme Court has left a decision in place, right? And I guess we don't know these things because those things are held closely. And so if they left it in place because it's a good decision, then since the decision is binary, I guess we never know whether it is a quote good or quote bad thing for voting rights.
Well, I also, if you've clerked for the Supreme Court, you know that there's a phrase that the law clerks use called a vehicle problem. And what a vehicle problem is that it may be, if the court takes the case, that it's actually not going to be able to reach the question it wants to reach. And there were questions about whether or not it was there was a vehicle problem there.
One thing that strikes me as interesting about North Carolina is that partisan warfare there has been so bitter. There are national divisions that are bitter, national polarization that have gotten so nasty. And it strikes me that North Carolina is a bit of a laboratory for these things, where some of the worst partisan divisions and some of the willingness to really play hardball. I remember what little law I know. At one point, I read this article called Constitutional Hardball by Mark Tushnet, all about the ways in which actors can stay within the rules and technically be following the rules, but gradually move the ball downfield. And by the time the dust is cleared, suddenly the law is completely different. And it feels like North Carolina legislators and also the former governor, McCrory, have been willing to do whatever it takes to get the gains that they would like to see.
Well, so I'll just tell you, I worry that that's happening everywhere. I mean, I still remember in the days that this was all occurring, I was reading red and blue blogs and red and blue Twitter feeds. And what you discover is that there are two different universes, one of which was looking at what was happening in North Carolina and thinking it was an appalling breach of existing political etiquette. And the other was looking at what the Obama administration was doing in the wake of the election and thinking the same thing. That is, partisan identity has become so fierce and so tribal that we are almost unable to process information ourselves on these kinds of questions. And as a result, my worry is that if partisan identity is that fierce, it excuses almost everything. If you think the other side is evil, then these kinds of sort of things that have always allowed us to get along in the election system, which is that there's you can go far but not too far, those norms are eroding so quickly these days, which is what I think you're seeing in North Carolina. Some of the things that they're doing, I think, are just unheard of. But those norms, I think, are eroding because partisan identity has become so powerful that there are no repercussions on one side for doing it, and the other side just finds a reason to do it someplace else. So my worry about the election system is that it has always been polarized. It's always been political, but the politics have never swamped the system itself. That is, we've always managed to move forward, and we're reaching a point where the warfare that's taking place there is wrecking the system, and I'm not sure it can sustain itself. In other words, one way to describe it is gerrymanderers always look like this, but it would be terrible if every election roll looked like gerrymandering.
I was just reading it in an article about reviewing districting practices in democracies around the world, and by self-report among, elected officials and others in nations around the world, the United States ranks worst in self-perceived gerrymandering. There's something about the practice of controlling your own boundaries, right, drawing your own district boundaries that is thought to be abused the worst in the United States than in other countries. I mean, I guess the opposite extreme is a nation like Israel, where there are no boundaries because it's just a national legislature that represents people proportionally.
Yeah, but most other countries, in one fashion or another, find a way to shield this more from politics than we do, and that's our core problem.
So you wrote a while ago the Democracy Index. You came up with this idea, which seems to be some kind of measure for getting at these issues, and Pew Foundation or Charitable Trust have used that to create an index. Can you tell us what this index is, what it tells us, and what its objectives are?
Sure. So one of the objectives is actually to start thinking about reform differently than most people think about it. So most people in the academy pronounce what the end result should look like, and they think they're done, as if reform, you could just add water. And we very rarely think of what I think of as the here to there solution. That is, even if we all have a picture of what we want the end to look like, how are we going to get from here to there? And election administration is one of those areas, right? So there's two kinds of problems. One is the problem of partisanship, which we just discussed. And one is just the simple problem of it's low, it doesn't get a lot of money in it. It doesn't have high levels of professionalism in some parts of the system that does in other parts of the system. The incentives aren't there to improve.
The actual voting, the nuts and bolts of the election system.
The mechanics of getting people a place to vote or getting them registered.
What machine do you buy? Right. Yeah. If you have to think about where you're going to put your money, do you buy a new machine or do you invest in roads and teachers and things that people can see? So there, we have a systematic problem, which is that people normally don't see problems in the election system until there's a crisis. So the kinds of things that we saw in Bush v. Gore, the kinds of things that we saw in Ohio, that we keep seeing in the problematic states, quote unquote, those happen all the time. It's just that the margin of victory was higher than the margin of error in those cases. So the election index, the idea of the Democracy Index, was to simply have a very nuts and bolts ranking of the simplest sort of things on which everyone agrees matter for an election system in order to harness people's incentives. And the idea was to harness it in two ways to do better. First is for the piece, for the partisan piece. Secretaries of State are ambitious. They want to move up on that ranking because many of them are going to run for higher office. And so one of the things you want to do is harness political ambitions in the service of useful reform. But the other piece of it is we just didn't have a lot of information on how the election system worked. We didn't even know what drove performance, let alone how people were performing. And so election administrators are like everybody else, right? They want to be professional. they're influenced by peers. And so the idea was to sort of use peer rankings and the incentives that you have just in doing your job well to encourage innovation, to encourage people to do better. And even just to find out, you know, the sort of basic science of election administration. Let me just give you one example. As I said before, we don't really know what drives performance. A lot of people thought it was money. And then when we ranked the states, we discovered there were poor states at the top and poor states at the bottom. One of the things we discovered was that states with high levels of obesity had more problems in getting their voters to the poll, which, of course, is something that if you really thought about it, you would guess that would be true.
Because of voter mobility?
Mobility and things like that. I mean, this is one of things. And what you'd find, actually, is that you see, and once you sort of start
voting on the third floor of the building,
when you disaggregate the numbers, you find actually that some of that is actually driving state performance. So the idea was to create an output measure that's quite neutral, run by a place like Pew, which is, you know, an extraordinarily well-trusted institution in the elections world, to create an incentive for reform. But it's a here-to-there solution, so it doesn't fix these problems, but it creates incentives for fixing these problems.
And what's the reaction been to this? I mean, have you traced that at all?
Yeah, no, I mean, the nice thing is it's two things that we've noticed. One is we actually are able to measure across time, which we couldn't do before. So one thing that we're able to do now is we're able to sort of get a sense of, are things getting better? And the answer is in many places they are, which is a good thing to know. Two, it has created some incentives to do the right thing.
Because it's measured.
So you see secretaries of state announcing that they want to... Yeah, exactly, like college rankings, exactly. And also pushing their legislators, using it as a tool to prod their legislators to go forward.
Huh, so these people are aware of their score on the democracy index?
Well, the most powerful moment I can remember, I will just tell you, is when we had a small working group of election administrators, just an extraordinarily gifted group from all across the country at every level of state and local governance. And we put them in a room. And we discussed it for a while. And we had useful discussions. And then one day we put the first numbers up. And there was silence in the room as they all absorbed where they ranked and why, and then an extraordinarily in-depth discussion about how to think about those numbers that we had just put up, which were only preliminary. And one of the people from Pew pulled me aside and said, this is going to work.
Good.
It's fine. It's an era of rankings. So it's a basic level. You know, you want to be in the top 10.
Yeah, exactly. Like everyone wants to be there. And so,
when it comes to all these things that make governments run well, I wonder if we can drill in just a little bit. I have the sense that with the mechanics of how elections are administered, sometimes it's hard to notice what the important factors are that govern representation. And I'm going to get into a topic that that is close to my heart, and I know you've done a lot of work in, which is racial and political gerrymandering. So we've seen a lot of action in this domain just in the last few weeks. There was, again, a North Carolina case, so we're back to North Carolina, with racial gerrymandering. How do you see that as being important? Let's start with that one, for affecting representation and affecting how groups get represented. Was that an important decision?
Yeah, I would say it was an incredibly important decision and an incredibly interesting...
Like a change, right?
A fundamental change. So yeah. I cut my teeth as a young lawyer defending majority-minority districts from these things called Shaw challenges. And a Shaw challenge is basically a claim that a district was racially gerrymandered, that race was the overriding factor in designing the district, and it was used to strike down a variety of bizarrely shaped districts that were drawn in the wake of the 1990s, the redistricting cycle. And it had an enormous effect. I think Mel Watt was up in front of the Supreme Court every 2 years, and his district was redrawn every 2 years under a Shaw challenge. Those challenges were brought by conservatives who didn't like the use of race in redistricting, and the Democrats were defending them because it were Democratic incumbents in most of these. The amazing thing is now it's Democrats and civil rights groups that are bringing these claims. And the claim is that race is still being used too much, but instead of being the overriding factor in the shape of the district, that they're packing in too many minority voters. And we all know when you pack a lot of minority voters into a district, you waste their votes. And as racially polarized voting has declined, you can still draw effective districts for racial minorities to elect their candidate of choice without packing a huge number of them in there.
I guess the way I would think about that is that majority-minority used to be necessary because if minorities were the only ones who voted on their side, then you needed to really pack them in there in order to give them a fighting chance. Now, as you're saying, so now a district could be, say, 30 or 40% African-American, and that would be enough for that community to get representation that reflects its interests. So the shift from majority-minority to I believe ability to elect is the term.
Exactly. And you get there by shifting into a two-part process, right? So in the old days, racially polarized voting was so severe that whites, no matter what their party, would not vote for the candidate of choice of Black or Latino voters. Now, there's still heavily racially polarized voting at the primary level, so you don't want to underestimate its existence. But as long as a Black or Latino community can get its candidate of choice through the primary, then white Democrats will cross over in a fashion that they didn't do in the early days. And so that's exactly right. You can get an effective district with much lower numbers.
Well, in that respect, a majority-minority district is like a political gerrymander in the sense that if you pack a district to be majority-minority, you've now stuck 80% Democrats into a district. And cases of political gerrymandering that are approaching the Supreme Court now for the fall also revolve around the same idea. So there is a similarity, even though, I don't know, say Justice Clarence Thomas might not see it that way, but there is this core concept that's the same between those two kinds of gerrymandering.
Well, so this is why in the 1990s, actually, you would often see these odd alignments where you'd see the Democrats on one side and you'd see the Republicans and civil rights groups on the other side, because sometimes they were aligned, right, in wanting to create these districts. Republicans were interested in them in part because they created heavily Democratic...
Because they could hive off the Blacks into one district.
But because when you did so, you also ended up creating heavily Democratic districts and oftentimes wasting some Democratic votes.
Yeah.
So the everything has realigned itself as those numbers have shifted.
So most people see the gerrymandering process and they understand it at some level, politicians carving out districts for their own party, parties protecting themselves. And it seems to be one of those issues that's hopeless for many people. I think that is the sentiment. Is that true? Or it doesn't seem like the solution will come from legislators, because they have no incentive at this point, unless you create an index somehow that shames them.
I don't even know if they're capable of shaming on this one.
Shaming legislators, that's good.
I mean, is there a better system that you have seen or been thinking about that would help us move forward? And can you maybe, again, for a layperson, what's going on in the courts right now? There's been a lot of cases, it seems, that are touching on this. What's going on in the courts to address this problem that we have that's right at the heart of some of the partisan problems we've discussed?
Almost any system is better than the system that we have now, I will say. Anything that moves us in a more nonpartisan direction is really useful. So some people, this is on the here to there question, think citizens' commissions are useful. Why? Because they tend to be pretty attractive to voters. Sometimes voters balk when you try to take things out of the hand of the legislature, but they'll vote for a citizens' commission as they did in California. And California has actually done quite interesting things with its citizens' commission. Nonpartisan commissions are standard elsewhere in the world, and they work just fine. So a nonpartisan commission is a good way to do it. I will say the one thing I don't believe in is random districting, because you need to be self-conscious about it. If you're not thoughtful about it, there are real democratic values at stake. Just think about racial minorities, right? If you randomly district, you could disempower them completely, or you could give them more power than their numbers would suggest that they might wield. So you have to make conscious decisions about it, about which values matter to you, so you can't just do it blindly. But almost any system works better than the one we have now.
So a citizens commission, just you guys know how this works. So average citizens are appointed?
Oh, yeah, in California?
Right.
You can go to a website and sign up to be on, if you're a California voter, I can't do it from Princeton.
You sign up.
You sign up and then what? Like people who work in the California government get rid of people who have conflicts of interest, get rid of people who are relatives of politicians. Yeah, and then there's a selection made of whoever makes the cut. And the people who are left get to be in the commission.
But you should just know it's not like they're sitting down randomly with a map, right? And you're having
of
citizens
people,
draw
have
something.
To actually weigh all the priorities.
Right, exactly. Right. So you can have a bunch of skilled map makers in front of you. I don't know if you've ever drawn districts. It's really fun to do. But you can decide what you want to be the values, and so you can give people a set of choices, and they can tell you what they prioritize, and you can show them what it looks like, and almost any choice that people are going to make will be better than what legislators will do, because legislators only have one idea in mind, which is to ensure their own re-election. So that's how they work.
Voices, though, that's not politicians.
No, it's they bring in a set of experts who
right. There are people
folks
who
like
serve
yourself.
Them, and so they don't. So you don't. They don't have to like. download the software and
set it up. And so that's one solution. Then you have nonpartisan commissions who are prominent people without strong ties or from both parties.
Yeah.
To hammer this out.
Yeah, I mean, they're even having some places are having election contests. They're not binding, but you will discover that the random folks from the population can sit down and draw a fair districting plan in the legislature easily and still adhere to all the values that the legislature says it's pretending to adhere to when it's really not. So there's lots of options here, and they're all better than the system that we currently use.
And is there anything coming out of the court? So I think of the one man, one vote decisions in 62 to 1964, which almost created a template that people had to follow. Is there anything like that that could come out of the courts now that would change what states can even do?
So the court has been highly reluctant to regulate partisan gerrymanders. So when it did one person, one vote, which we now look back as something that's completely uncontroversial, at the time it was quite controversial. And Justice Frankfurter said we were moving into the political thicket and that would be a terrible mistake by the courts. So the places where the court has been willing to intervene is one person, one vote. And it's been willing to intervene with regard to uses of race because it feels like the Equal Protection Clause licensed it to do that. And it has a long history of protecting the voting rights of racial minorities. The question about partisan gerrymandering is up again. The court, last time it had this question, split 4-1-4, by which I mean that four justices agreed that the court should take cases like that and announce a standard. Four justices said it was non-justiciable, which is a sort of a lawyerly word meaning that we can't get into this, we lack the expertise, we can't find manageable standards, it would be a mistake for the court to do this. And one justice being on neither side, Justice Kennedy, you might recognize him as the swing vote.
Oh, yes. And neither side. 80 years old on
yes,
the court now.
Exactly. So Justice Kennedy is, I think, the last and best hope of getting a partisan gerrymandering standard in before the next redistricting cycle. And there's a case that's on its way up from Wisconsin that at least tees up the question for the court, should it choose to address it.
And what's that? What would a standard, what does that mean?
Well, this is a really key issue. The court is always worried about looking like it's taking sides. Mm-hmm. And we all know that in the fraught world of gerrymandering, choices that you make often will have an effect on one side or the other. So the court has been looking for a standard that it feels is manageable in the sense that it both can be implemented by judges and not require enormously difficult calculations that are invisible to judges, and two, one that's manageable in the sense that it doesn't leave judges vulnerable to claims of partisanship. That is, it doesn't involve undue discretion by judges and things like that, because they want to protect the judiciary from looking like it's taking sides. So manageability is both a kind of pragmatic approach. It's about sort of just what works if you're a judge and what can courts and lawyers do. And then there's a piece of it which is about the court's own concern about keeping track of its political capital.
I think one of the principles, if I recall correctly, that several judges in that case expressed interest in justices was partisan symmetry, the idea of in some way detecting whether the major parties have been treated asymmetrically, and then that would be the basis for striking down a map for being excessively asymmetric in one direction or the other. And then it turns into a question of how to define that.
Right. Well, and that's an attractive standard for a variety of reasons. So one, it's neutral. It doesn't require the court to make judgments that it might otherwise make about something that would favor one party or another. For example, if the court were to choose a compactness standard, for example, that might have a disparate effect on one side or the other because of the way people are distributed.
Yeah,
so it's very
asymmetric.
Right. It's clean and neutral. The other advantage is it's a very common standard in law. So oftentimes in law, when you're trying to figure out if discrimination has occurred, then the test that you use is you imagine what if the roles were reversed? Would things be different? So in employment, for example, you try to imagine if a black candidate didn't get a job, would the white candidate with similar qualifications have gotten the job? So the idea of sort of turning the tables and switching sides and seeing if the story that you're being told would be different if you flipped the identity of the people in question, that's a very common standard in other areas of discrimination law.
But I think that compactness has the argument going against it that it allows asymmetry and that people live asymmetrically. And so now there's this asymmetry built into what is seemingly a fair and neutral concept. So that feels like there's a loophole right in the middle of that one.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. That compactness would not be a good standard because at the end of the day, that's actually, it leads to exactly the problems you want, which is an asymmetry standard or a partisan symmetry standard works better because it works across maps and doesn't require those kinds of judgments.
I want to completely change the subject now that we're nearing the end here, which is that a lot of these issues affect people, but they seem kind of technical. And I saw in a newspaper article that you wrote for the New York Times that for you, everything is storytelling. And so we've kind of gotten into the technical domain, and it doesn't feel like storytelling, but the domain for our listeners where you talked about storytelling was in the composition of vampire novels. And you, I did ask you in advance whether this is going to be okay. And so I guess I'm going to turn this into a serious question, which is there any way to synthesize your composition of vampire novels where you tell a story or you convey a lesson through a story and how you think about the law? Is there something shared here?
Sure, although I feel the need for your listeners to make it clear that I am a serious person, that those vampire novels were written solely for my daughter, trying to sort of embed all the things I wanted to say to her when she was a teenager by writing her as a heroine. So there are lessons in there about how to have a male best friend, how to tell angry nerds from good nerds, how to be a woman in a male-dominated environment. These are things that I was afraid if she became a teenager and would stop listening to me that she wouldn't hear. So
your lessons without being too didactic.
Lessons embedded in tales of romance and magic and things like that. And the greatest Romeo and Juliet story that can be told these days is a vampire novel. It's the last domain for kids. They can't imagine why anything would keep you apart, even sexual orientation. But interspecies love, they get that. So you can still play the Romeo and Juliet card. Back to the more serious question, I actually do think that lawyers are storytellers. In fact, all of our training is about telling someone else's story in a language that they don't have access to. And it doesn't matter who your client is or what they want to do, lawyers are in essence there to tell your story in the most effective way possible for that domain.
For me, I have to say, as a math guy and as a science guy, I get the appeal, but there's just something in me that wants the graphs, that wants the charts. To me, those charts tell a story. And so I never really thought about illustrating a figure in a paper with interspecies love or something like that.
I love the story.
I
get it in some ways with the index that you talked about, because it is telling a story. Even though it's not a narrative, you're finding a way to tell a story of this huge issue that we have.
Yeah,
so
and if you want to know, I got to say, Sam, if it were just about graphs and numbers, then we would have election reform, because that story is easily told with numbers. What's hard is to put a human face on it. It's not resonant with people as is losing your insurance or getting a
job. Lestat, the redistrictor.
Let me ask for a final question. So you're taking over, you're becoming dean in July. One of the best law schools in the world, with students who will go on to do all sorts of things. How do you imagine what the role of the law school is now in what many people think is a turbulent time, an uncertain time? What are you looking for in terms of what your students will learn, not simply the technicalities of the law, but what the law is in the future?
I think there are two values that lawyers have to teach. So one is rule of law values. That is, these are things that are deep within our profession. They are nonpartisan. And I think one of the most amazing things of the last few months has been watching lawyers defend the rule of law in a fashion that both sides find completely right, because they run so deep inside our profession. When you fight about everything, and some things manage to last over centuries, some values last for centuries despite lawyers trying to poke holes in them, that's called a rule of law value. And so one role is the sort of, I think, heroic role of lawyers in defending the rule of law. But the other one, and this is less, I think, obvious but equally important, is that lawyers are trained to go to war without turning the other side into an enemy. That is, we know how to be righteous without being self-righteous. And that is because from the first day you walk into class, you are forced to argue for the other side, to reconstruct empathetically the best arguments the other side can make, to find holes in every single thing that you're making, in every claim that you're making. And that sort of almost self-reflexive checking yourself and doubting yourself while recognizing the best in the other side is a value we have lost in politics. And lawyers, I think we really do remain the one tribe that is capable in a lot of sort of the world of policy domain right now, which is capable of doing those things. So I'll just say election lawyers, we're all really good friends. And we go to war with each other every 4 years.
I find it mind-blowing that lawyers are able to do this with one another, including opposing counsel. Although I will say in the current climate, I think the rule of law sometimes gets expressed by some people in public life as the deep state. And when I hear someone complain, say the President of the United States or whoever complain about the deep state, I had this thought, are you complaining about some hidden forces? Or are you complaining about the fact that the rule of law is supposed to apply to all of us?
Right.
Which are you complaining about there? Yeah. And so this value seems like something that is one of the few things that we have left to rely on.
And notice, I'll just note one thing about the rule of law, and this is just taking it outside of the context of the United States. When you look across the world, who are the last offenders of a democracy? They're often the lawyers, because those rule of law values are so deep within the profession across the world, and lawyers are the ones who stand up for it in the end. So there's something that we sometimes forget with all the lawyers' jokes, something heroic about the profession. It's been nice to see. I told the new admits who are coming to Yale next year that they may be the first generation in a long while not to hear lawyer jokes.
I have a student who's studying abroad for 2 years. He graduated here, and he's going to your institution next year. He's starting, and he's been emailing me over the year, kind of eager, should I go back early? Like, this is the time I need to be at law school. So I think you're going to have a lot of energy in your classes that is important that it's handled well, given where things are. But unfortunately, that wraps up our episode. So thanks again, Heather, for joining us on the show. It's terrific to have you. And thanks to everyone for joining us. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Thank you very much.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.